This bumper music brought to you by Jim McKinney. And Jim, you've been hanging out with Tim Abramowski way too long. And as a result, you've picked up Rush. Next thing you'll be, what? Oh, okay.
I like Rush.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I do.
Okay. I just, Tim Abramowski rubs off on you. You've always liked Rush before working with Tim? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, the bumper music brought to you by Jim McKinney. He stopped by this afternoon just to play bumper music for us.
Yeah,
590 WKZO time is coming up on 10 minutes after 4 o'clock. Rog Taylor and Michael and Jim McKinney. And now Bob Fuss driving you home this afternoon. Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Let's talk about Harry Reid's nuclear option. We were discussing this in the last half hour, and I had a caller who said Democrats were actually worse at blocking George Bush judicial nominees than the Republicans have been. Can you give that off the top of your head a reality check?
Well, it depends how you count it. There is no question that the Democrats used filibusters to block a lot of President Bush's judicial nominees. And in fact, this nuclear option was first proposed by Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, at that time. And they decided not to do it. They came to an agreement instead, and more of those nominees got confirmed. The situation, there's no question, though, over the past few years, has just gotten much, much worse. I mean, the Senate is just, you know, gets nothing done these days. It's very hard to do anything because basically every measure, even non-controversial measures, are just automatically filibustered. And so, you know, there's been a lot of pressure to sort of change these filibuster rules. Now, this didn't get rid of all the filibusters, but what it does is it says that filibusters for nominees, presidential nominees other than the Supreme Court, those nominations cannot be filibustered. And, you know, that will last until the rules are changed again. But once, you know, this kind of red line has been crossed now, and so it will now be much easier for another majority, be it Democrat or Republican, to get rid of more filibusters when they choose.
But I think embedded in your comments is the key to this, that it's rules. It isn't the Constitution that required the supermajority.
Oh, no. And in fact, one can make the argument that you know, the Constitution says quite the opposite. You know, the Constitution makes clear that there should be a majority vote on everything except impeaching a president and treaty confirmations.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's a question as to whether it was constitutional at all. But the Constitution also says that the House and Senate can make their own rules. And the Senate made this one, you know, well over 100 years ago and has kept it. But it is a Senate rule, and it can be changed by the Senate, and it has been.
Yeah. My view of this is we need a functional government, and removing of this rule right now may actually benefit the Democrats because they held a majority in the Senate. But in future years, this could come back to haunt Democrats if the Republicans are in the majority in the Senate, and they have to live with the majority rule.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about that. And there's no question that at some point in our future there will be a Republican president, and that president will nominate somebody Democrats don't like. And at that point, you know, they will be where the Republicans are now, which is that, you know, unable to stop that nominee unless they can get a majority of the Senate. And so it's a sea change. It's a very big change. In terms of, you know, the argument on one side is that, you know, the current system just isn't working. It's just too hard to get anything done. On the other side, the argument is that the filibuster gives power to the minority that they wouldn't otherwise have. And that switches back and forth between the Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And that power for the minority will now be gone.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard any rumblings of retaliation for this? Is there anything the conservatives in the Senate can do to get even at this point?
Well, I mean, there are all kinds of things they can do to cause problems and delay things, and we might see some of that. But, you know, frankly, I think the you know, in terms of retaliation, it comes if and when they get the majority back.
Okay.
And you know, that warning was made very clearly today. And you know, basically what Harry Reid is saying is that, you know, absolutely bring it on, that he believes this is better for the country and better for the Senate, and understands full well that someday, you know, Democrats are going to want to use a filibuster and now not be able to.
Did the Democrats lose any members in this vote, or was it the strict party line vote?
There were a few. I think they lost three Democrats who voted against it.
Well,
and, you know, it has taken Harry Reid a while to get a majority, because a lot, especially of the older senators who've been around a while, you know, were very reluctant to change such a basic rule. A lot of the impetus here really came from younger senators who were just think that this, you know, rule is undemocratic and doesn't make any sense. But the trigger really were these nominations the president made to the district court, appeals court in Washington, which is a very powerful, important court. And basically Republicans took the position of, we don't care who the nominees are, we're going to oppose them because we don't want the president to fill those slots. And they said, both because of political reasons and also because they made the argument that they didn't think that court needed more judges. But that was really the straw, I think, that broke the camel's back for the Democrats.
We're talking with Bob Fuss, CBS News Capitol Hill correspondent. And before I let you go, I had another caller who suggests that there isn't enough work in that appellate court to justify at filling the three open seats. I recall hearing John Roberts suggest that the judgeships needed filling. Have you seen anything that would lead a person to believe that there was no need for those judges, that the court could be smaller and still handle its caseload?
That is one argument that has been made by Republicans, that this court doesn't have enough to do. But what's critical here is that what it does do is incredibly important, in that this is the court that decides, for example, you know, that would make the important judgments about whether, you know, presidential orders and executive decisions and decisions by agencies are valid. And so it's a very important court politically. You know, I'm not in a position to really judge whether they have enough work to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that, you know, the president doesn't decide how many judges go on a court. Congress sets that up. I mean, Congress, there's a law that determines how many judges serve on each of these courts in the country, each of these federal courts. And so, and as far as I know, there's never been an effort to change that law to reduce the number of judges on this court.
Mm-hmm.
They simply took the position that there are too many, and therefore they won't confirm President Obama's nominee.
Yeah, and they're misusing the term court packing. Filling an open judgeship is not packing a court. Previous court packing included perhaps doubling the number of judges and then putting all of your party into those new seats. Filling openings has not been viewed as court packing in the past. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate your taking time to talk with us this afternoon.
Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bob Fuss, CBS News Capitol Hill correspondent, and we have some traffic news. We shouldn't have brought it up.
Yeah, we shouldn't have brought it up.
It's my fault. Where's our problem?
Okay, tipster called me and said that there's two cars in the right-hand lane on westbound Milam at Constitution that are they're just stopped. They have their hazard lights on. And then there's one car stopped in the right-hand lane northbound Oakland at Kilgore, also with their hazard lights on. So just be cautious out there and watch out for those cars.
So we've got some stalled vehicles mm-hmm. out there on the roads. Let's not make those the scene of a traffic accident,
please,
folks.
Please, no.
Yeah. Let's just keep it at we have a couple of stalled cars to move out of the way. 590 WKZO time is 418, and we've still got, we're down to 49 degrees, so we've seen our high for the day. Thanks to the tipsters for letting people know where there are some stalled cars. 382-4280. 877-382-4280 if you see something else that people need to know about. .422-590 WKZO. Roger and Michael riding home with you this afternoon, and has spring training opened? Is that the big Tiger news you were referring to?
No, that actually doesn't happen until February.
Okay.
But last night I was just sitting home watching Revolution on TV, and all of a sudden there's a notification on my iPod, so I look at it from Wood TV 8, and it says, breaking news, the Tigers have traded Prince Fielder to the Texas Rangers for Ian Kinsler. So that is the big news from the Detroit Tigers. So Kinsler's a second baseman, so they're going to probably move Cabrera back over to first base to help him out with his maneuverability issues and, of course, with the injury he just had this year. So they're probably going to be looking for a third baseman. They might put Nick Castellanos there, but then they'd have to go out and probably get a left fielder. So interesting times for the Detroit Tigers, and some fans are probably saying, well, this is a bad trade. Fielder just was having an off year. But in all honesty, I think it's good. I think fans were expecting Prince to live up to what his dad did, Cecil, in Detroit. And now he's going to be out of that shadow. And in Texas, which is a much friendlier ballpark for home runs. So I bet you Prince Fielder will do well in Texas. And I think the Tigers are going to do well, too, with Kinsler. And this moves money down so they could possibly re-sign Max Scherzer and not have to trade him away. So that's more good news for the Tigers.
So you think this was a reasonable business decision?
I think it was. It's just going to open up that opportunity to re-sign Max Scherzer possibly.
And so what does he do?
He's the pitcher. He just won the Cy Young Award. So you don't really want to trade away someone like that. And he's going to be wanting more money after this year. He still has 1 year left on his contract, but now the pressure seems to be off of trying to trade him away.
Okay. And so you see this as a positive.
Yes, I do.
You're in a good mood with this.
Yes, Fielder was signed for 10 years, and he was through 2 years of his contract, and by the end of his contract, he'd have been 36, so he'd have been over the hill for a baseball player. So it was probably good to just give him to Texas and let them deal with his big contract.
Okay. I got to open this up to listeners because I've got no idea if this is a good idea or not.
We're going to hear people that are going to say it's good. We're going to hear people say it's bad. So everyone's got their opinion.
But what
that.
I want to know, I want to see is who's in majority of the people who call. I'm getting a I want to see if there's an endorsement of your, this is a good thing to do. Or are you wrong in this? And the majority of Tiger fans think that we shouldn't have messed with success.
Well, in the playoffs, he only batted .225 and he had zero home runs and zero RBI, so he didn't produce anything for the Tigers in the playoffs this year.
Okay. 382-4280, 877-382-4280. Give me a call and just thumbs up, thumbs down. Is this a good deal for the Detroit Tigers? And Michael is right there by the phone and ready for business. Be a reality check here for me. As you know, if you've listened for very long, I don't know much about this sports stuff. And I got no idea if this is important. Get Jim to stop by the mic and ask him if he thinks this was a good deal for the Tigers.
Jim agrees.
That got an affirmative, yeah. Walker, do you know anything about baseball, or are you like me?
No, I'm so concentrated in my understanding that I know almost everything about nothing.
I see. Everything about nothing.
That's what happens to the technical guys. You get to know almost everything about nothing.
Right. Well, thank you. 382-4280, 877-382-4280. Is this trade, is this a good deal?
Yeah.
It is?
Yes.
So you got one endorsement, Michael.
Yeah, it's good for a couple of reasons, Roger. Number one, it's a salary dump, and the Tigers needed a salary dump because they need to re-sign Max Scherzer. They're going to have to get a closer, and according to all indications, that could be Joe Nathan.
Yes.
Because Torrey Hunter's talking to him, and that'd be a great, because then we can move Benoit back. But I think it opens up first base, and everybody's saying, oh, Cabrera can go back to first base. Well, you forget Victor Martinez, okay, could go to first base.
He could.
Technically, that opens up a designated hitter spot for somebody else on the roster, and whoever that might be could be fine. But I'm looking at putting Austin Jackson and Ian Kinsler at the top of the order, both of whom can steal bases, and that allows them to move Torrey Hunter down to the bottom, close to the bottom of the lineup. Then you start building a lineup that's not going to rely on a three-run homer all the time. You've got to watch out for doubles and triples and singles and all sorts of stuff. Turns them into a different kind of team. Mm. And they scored all sorts of runs this year. They could really score some runs this year. And Kinsler can steal bases.
Mm-hmm. So you guys who are into this stuff, you can talk baseball year-round. There's no off-season.
Oh, no way.
No. You're engaged in thinking about this?
Oh, yeah.
These are not the boys of summer to you as we head into Thanksgiving and Christmas. You're still thinking baseball.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, and it's funny because they always, you know, they've said NFL has taken over baseball. Not necessarily.
No.
Because I don't talk about NFL year-round, but I'll talk about baseball year-round.
Now, why is that?
Probably because I grew up with baseball being the national pastime. I mean, I liked NFL football. I was always a Lions fan, but I wasn't a big Pistons or Red Wings fan. But I was a Tigers, dyed-in-the-wool Tigers fan. And always will be. And that's why.
My mother was a Tigers fan, but that was second place to her Cubs.
Oh, okay.
She loved the Cubs. And whenever she would start a baseball game, my dad and I would go shopping and get out of the house because she used to yell and shout and get engaged in the game. And so my dad and I would go look at cars and leave the house. But I guess a non-traditional family, my grandfather played semi-professional ball here in town.
Oh, wow.
And she was brought up on ball diamonds and for her whole life had an interest in baseball.
There you go.
So, yeah, I just got a couple endorsements. One lady said that it's a good trade. We might miss him, but she thinks it'll be good. Another guy said we might miss his 100 RBIs, but we won't miss his stone glove at first base.
So, everybody supports your calling. This was a good move.
Yes.
That says something. I'm developing a level of trust now when you tell me something is good in the world of sports, because I got no detector.
He is Mr. Sports,
yeah.
After all.
Yeah. What was it I said? My classic was I referred to the Pistons playing the White Sox.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jim,
only in donkey basketball or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Jim pointed out the error of my thought process on that. That would be a good game, though, you got to admit.
Could be fun.
It would be interesting to watch.
I'm sure the White Sox could play basketball.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Not sure the Pistons could play baseball.
No, I don't think so.
We played one year when I was in a different radio life. We played the Detroit Lions in basketball. And Rob Rubick, who at that time was a tight end for the Lions, said, look, don't try to show these guys up. They may not be football players, but they're athletes.
Yeah. WKZO 431. WKZO. Roger and Michael riding home with you this afternoon. The WKZO.com AccuWeather forecast. Cloudy and chilly. Some light rain on occasion. Periods of rain tonight into tomorrow morning and a low of 38. Cloudy, brisk, and chilly tomorrow, 41 the high. Windy and sharply colder tomorrow. Into Saturday with snow showers, a low tomorrow night, 25, the high Saturday, 34. There could be some accumulations of snow, especially closer to Lake Michigan. We've got 49 in Kalamazoo right now. And Bob Larson from AccuWeather told us that this is just the beginning of a very cold week coming up. And pretty much guaranteed to have a white Thanksgiving now, according to Bob Larson. Joining us now is Sade Gabra Selassie, and she is with the National Employment Law Project. And she's joining us to talk about raising the minimum wage. Good afternoon, Sade. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Roger. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
What prompted my call to you folks today was the Cleveland Plain Dealer yesterday had a story about a Walmart in northeastern Ohio that was encouraging its employees to have a food drive for their fellow employees.
Right.
And in my mind, this is the poor trying to help the drastically poor.
Right, right.
And on a moral level, it just offends me. The Walton family, the six people who make up that family, make more money than the bottom 41.6% of Americans combined.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we can't pay a living wage for working in America.
Mm-hmm.
There. I got that off my chest.
Well, that's what I was going to say, so.
Well, thanks for joining
us. You don't need
us.
Me, yeah. Done.
What is the great majority of Americans, even the majority of Republicans, think we need to raise the minimum wage?
Yep. I mean, yeah. So the minimum wage federally is $7.25 an hour, and in Michigan it's $7.40 an hour. That translates to about $15,000 a year, assuming full-time work, which the reason why raising the minimum wage is so popular regardless of political affiliation is because everybody recognizes that that is not adequate to support yourself, let alone a family. And I think what the Walmart food drive and all the press that it's been getting these last couple of days really shows is that it's proof that Walmart pays its workers so little that they're forced to rely on food donations or food stamps and other public assistance programs just to make ends meet. And that is, you know, galling in general, but it's especially galling considering that Walmart is such a hugely profitable company.
Oh, yeah. Well, a few months ago, I was out of town, and I needed some things from a grocery store, and the only place available was a Walmart. Mm-hmm. And I was standing at the deli, and I was looking at two different kinds of cooked beef. And I asked the person who was waiting on me if the more expensive roast beef was worth the extra money. And he said, "I don't know. I work at Walmart. I can't afford that."
Mm-hmm.
And that stuck with me. That whole weekend, that's one of the memories I came away from. This right. poor guy saying, "I don't know, I can't afford that."
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the average hourly wage for a Walmart associate is around $9 an hour. So their workers are not able to afford, you know, the brand name beef, let alone things that Walmart is selling, even in their own stores. I mean, the thing is that, you know, Walmart posted $17 billion in profits last year. It compensated its CEO more than $20 million, but it's saying that it can't afford to pay its associates a decent hourly wage. And so what that means, you know, for the workers is that they can't make ends meet. What it means for the rest of us is that we're effectively subsidizing the rock bottom wages that Walmart is paying its workers, because they're basically using us, the taxpayer, to pad their corporate profits. And so that is, you know, offensive.
On multiple levels, that's offensive. And we're bashing Walmart here, but McDonald's in their right. somebody wasn't thinking when they posted this on their
bad
website.
Public relations.
suggesting to their employees that if you're a little tight on money, you know, you can return those Christmas presents mm-hmm. for cash.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't just Walmart that's using the taxpayer money to subsidize their profits.
Right.
There's a number of companies who are doing it.
And then McDonald's, too, is a hugely profitable corporation. It posted $5.5 billion in profits back in 2011 and compensated its CEO, I think, $13 or $14 million a year. So it's an example of another company that can absolutely afford to pay higher wages. I mean, I think the thing about – it's not just the fact that these companies are paying poverty wages. It's that they are the largest employers, private sector employers in our country. I mean, Walmart employs 1.4 million workers. Mm-hmm. McDonald's employs another 800,000 or 900,000 workers just in this country. So their labor practices are basically setting the standard for the bottom of our labor market.
Yeah.
And so,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and so if we have a minimum wage that is $7.25 an hour, you know, that's the minimum that they can pay their workers, we have got to figure out a way to raise that wage floor, because millions of workers are making, you know, $7, $8, $9 an hour. And so if we don't find a way to raise it closer to what it used to be, you know, there was a time when the minimum wage, while still not a living wage, was much higher in terms of inflation-adjusted terms. It had it kept pace with the cost of living just over the last 40 years, it would be almost $11 an hour today. And so we have really lost significant ground these last decades. And, you know, the proof is in the fact that millions of workers are living in poverty, even as they work full time.
Well, and these two companies that we mentioned do business in other parts of the world where paying a living wage is required,
mm-hmm.
and they still operate there.
Yep.
And unless they're nuts, that means they're making money there in those countries. If they were losing money, they wouldn't be there.
Right.
And so when you see these companies paying a living wage in other parts of the world, just not in the United States, that sends a message as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Sade Gabra Selassie, and she's with the National Employment Law Project. Okay, we've justified, at least in my mind, the increase in the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get Congress to listen to the American people?
Right, who overwhelmingly support raising the minimum wage.
Republicans.
As you noted. Yep. Even, I mean, every single poll that has come out shows huge bipartisan support for raising the minimum wage. Well, so, I think, you know, first we have to, you know, oftentimes the states are the ones leading the way on this and prompting Congress to act. So in the last year, we've seen 4 states either pass legislation or, in the case of New Jersey, pass a ballot initiative to raise their state's minimum wages. So
over the veto of the governor they reelected in the same election.
That's right. And so that again shows that raising the minimum wage is a bipartisan issue, because in New Jersey they both reelected Governor Christie and then also voted an increase in the minimum wage. So I think, you know, Congress looks at that and looks at the fact that come January there will be 21 states that have minimum wages above the federal level. I think the other thing is just, you know, putting pressure on Congress to do something, which I know is very difficult, especially in these political times. But one of the reasons why the federal minimum wage has fallen so far below in value is because it only goes up when Congress gets its act together to pass an increase. And in the last 30 years, they have only voted to raise the minimum wage 3 times. And so we have to make sure that Congress not only raises the minimum wage to a significant level, but does another thing, which is index it to inflation so that it automatically adjusts every year to keep pace with the cost of living, and so that we don't have to rely on, you know, getting Congress to vote every year to raise the minimum wage.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more that we can't have this fight every time we need to increase the minimum wage.
Right.
Is it just the fact that Walmart and McDonald's are stuffing money into politicians' pockets? Is that why they ignore their constituents and remain opposed to increasing the minimum wage?
I mean, I think that there is, you know, tremendous lobbying that happens on the other side, you know, in terms of getting Congress and state legislatures too not to raise the minimum wage. I think that we're in an economic situation now where that's just untenable. I mean, it was always untenable, you know, to have a full-time worker make just $15,000 a year, but our economy has so dramatically shifted to, you know, a service sector economy where the bulk of the job growth is disproportionately concentrated in low-wage industries like fast food, like retail, like home health care, jobs where median wages are less than $10 an hour. And so raising the minimum wage isn't just, you know, a moral necessity and something that's good for workers. I think it's an economic necessity to keep our economy growing and to make sure that we have, you know, a base of people who can actually go out and spend money because they have money, you know, stimulate the consumer spending that our economy needs to grow. I mean, if you look at who would benefit from the federal minimum wage bill that's currently before Congress, which would raise the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, it would affect about 1 in 5 workers. And that shows you, one, not just the sheer scale of impact that raising the minimum wage would have, but two, how low wage our economy has become. You know, the fact that 1 in 5 workers would benefit from raising the minimum wage to $10 an hour.
Well, and the people who would benefit from that increase in the minimum wage are not going to be stashing their extra money in offshore bank accounts
in the
Cayman Islands.
Exactly.
Because every penny they have is involved in keeping their head above water on a day-to-day basis.
Yep. And then the other thing, too, is the people that will benefit from raising the minimum wage are overwhelmingly adult, and that's another thing that often gets lost in the debate. There's this misconception that the minimum wage and low-wage workers are disproportionately teenagers that are, you know, just getting spending money or going out on Friday night money, but 87% of workers who would benefit from raising the federal minimum wage are over the age of 20. And so this is really an issue that affects you know, a large segment of our workforce, disproportionately adults, many of whom are supporting families.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, people that are going to go out and spend the money immediately on basic necessities in their local communities and help stimulate the consumer spending that our economy really needs in order to grow.
Yeah. Sade, before I let you go, and we are running out of time,
sure.
But one of the reasons for not increasing the minimum wage is that it's a big jobs killer.
Mm-hmm.
And have you seen any research into whether or not that's true, or if that's just another one of the right-wing myths?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of research, and the most rigorous of it over the last 20 years has pretty clearly shown that raising the minimum wage boosts worker pay without causing job loss. There was a great study that looked at, this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but looking at what happened when you raise the minimum wage in one state versus the state next door, and did it cause job loss in that state with the higher minimum wage, and it found that it didn't, even in cases where there was even in regions, for example, where the economy was weak. And that's for a number of factors, and that's because of a number of factors. One, when you raise the minimum wage, you know, you get reduced employee turnover, and that translates to savings for the employer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another is just because our minimum wage is so low, oftentimes we're just talking about raising it back to where it used to be and where companies used to be able to, you know, were absolutely able to pay. And so the research very clearly shows that that is not a concern.
Thank you very much. And I've really enjoyed talking with you. Which,
yeah, the ditto. Thank you.
Which pretty much guarantees I'll darken your doorway sometime in the future and having
Excellent.
You back.
Great.
Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you so much, Roger.
You bet.
Bye.
Sade Gebrselassie, and she is from the National Employment Law Project, and I think she laid to waste any reason you might have for not increasing the minimum wage and letting people get out of poverty. It's time to stop subsidizing Walmart and McDonald's profits out of our tax dollars. Well, that's going to do it for Michael and I. Cloudy and chilly with some rain into tomorrow morning. Have a good evening, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow at 3.
Kalamazoo's news, weather, and traffic station is 590 WKZO. Kalamazoo.